Now stay tuned for the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on 97.9 The Wren. The Wake Up Call talks with the people in Charlottesville and Albemarle County who are making a difference. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
Hey, good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for being here on The Wren Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. Lots to talk about today. We're going to talk about using media in politics. Our guest, Professor Bruce Williams, UVA's Department of Media Studies. Professor Williams received his PhD in political science from the University of Minnesota. He's taught at Penn State, University of Michigan, Illinois, London School of Economics, interested in the relationship between media and democratic politics, with a current focus on the role of changing media environment in shaping citizenship in the United States. His most recent book is After Broadcast News, Media Regimes, Democracy, and the New Information Environment. Professor Williams, thanks for being here.
Oh, it's great to be here.
It certainly has worked out to be a fabulous Sunday to discuss media and politics with the changeover in administrations when we started talking about you coming in over a month ago.
Yes. That's one of the things about studying and teaching and writing about what I do is I have to get used to things changing very rapidly. Certainly things have been changing very rapidly since you first reached out.
Well, one of the topics that I originally wanted to discuss was the change in media, both in presentation and distribution, that was going to take place beginning Wednesday, January 20th, between the Trump administration and the Biden administration. Because the Trump administration did things quite differently. They weren't doing things in the standard protocols of previous presidential ways. So I'd like to talk about that to start with. So let's just do the basics. What is the role of a presidential press conference? And will the current administration do them when the former administration rarely did?
So I think certainly they have, the Biden administration has promised to return to the more standard, having very frequent, even daily, press briefings. And in terms of the difference in the Trump administration, as we all know, Donald Trump picked a new and a relatively new means of communicating with the public, using Twitter, using other forms of social media, really to go around the more traditional means that presidents have had to communicate with the public. And one of the reasons press conferences are there, one of the reasons that most presidents communicate the way they do is because we want them to be subject to questions and asked to refine what they mean and just be called to account in what winds up being the way they speak to the American people. Donald Trump, and I'm not going to get into too many things about Donald Trump, except that this embrace of social media is both important and it's had I think, very significant effects on the way events over the last couple of months have played out. But it's also important to point out that this idea of presidents trying to get around the formal, the traditional ways of communicating with the public is not new. One of the presidents who really pioneered something that is a little like Twitter was Franklin Delano Roosevelt and his fireside chats. What made them so powerful is that he could speak directly to individual Americans in their homes, and he created a relationship based on the sound of his voice, his reassurance, the kind of things he was communicating, that helped him enormously politically. And indeed, at the time, Republicans were very worried that because of this new means of communication, Roosevelt would be able to get elected forever. There was no chance that a Republican challenger could make a dent. And that it obviously didn't work out that way, but I think the fears around these new media for communicating with the public, that is an old story. It's been a struggle between political elites of all forms and the press over what gets communicated to the public. And I think that the the difference here is that in relying on Twitter, the Trump administration just dropped the more traditional forms of communicating with the public. And it's fascinating to me that once he was banned from Twitter and Facebook and YouTube and the other social media platforms that he was used to using, that he ceased communicating, really. It's ironic that when he's cut off from these newer forms of communicating with the public, he complains that his free speech rights somehow have been limited. But he has what gets called the bully pulpit of the president. He can get his message out to the public anytime he wants, as long as he's willing to speak it with journalists present.
And that's, you look back at from Wednesday or maybe Thursday, when the first press briefing was held. I believe the woman's name is Jennifer Psaki, and there were comparisons made between her first press briefing for President Biden and Sean Spicer's first press briefing for then President Trump. And the comparison was that Ms. Psaki's press briefing, and I'm put the quotes on, refreshingly boring, because there wasn't the emotions involved of shouting and negative word choice and et cetera that go with that.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point, because one of the things that I always encourage my students in how they think about the world is I always tell them that it's important to always think historically, to understand how new an issue is, what its history is, and so on. And I think that while the world of social media and how it has affected us, almost everything about our culture and politics and economics has been influenced by social media. At the same time, a lot of the issues that get raised, even in that comparison you made, Rick, between Biden and Trump, it gets to me to some very old and very basic issues that we've struggled with in the United States since the very founding. Is politics supposed to be entertaining and exciting? And I think that if you take away the substance, which is very important, what happened during the Trump administration, I think it raises that issue again. You know, probably the most famous debates in American history are the Lincoln-Douglas debates in 1858. And what's so interesting about those debates is that, first of all, they lasted for hours. They could last for an hour and a half or 2 hours, then everyone would go home to have a bite to eat, and then they would come back and they would resume. And the reason people did that is because they were entertained by what was happening. These were debates where there was a lot of audience participation, both yelling and asking questions of the candidates, and also a lot of the crowd, especially for the later session, was often drunk. And they would bring fruit or vegetables from their meals to throw at the speakers when they didn't like something that they were saying. So it's important not to romanticize the past and recognize the basic problem, I think, in creating a democratic society, which was recognized by the framers, is, you know, our political system, rooted in the Declaration of Independence, celebrates and highlights the importance of protecting individual freedom of thought and belief. And the framers didn't anticipate, obviously, the world we live in now, but they were concerned about how capable ordinary citizens would be of participating in a, what Jefferson, I think, at one point called enlightened manner. And for that reason, the United States pioneered public education. Because it was thought that it was vital that all citizens have a basic education, that they be literate, that they could read and write. And the United States, up until the end of the 19th century, had one of the highest literacy rates in the world. It was a marvel to people from Europe who traveled in the United States in the early and mid-19th century. And the problem is, so if we say that we have an individual freedom of thought and belief, and it's an individual right, then how do we construct public truth? That is, how do we agree enough on our basic understanding of the world around us that we can engage in democratic politics without devolving into violence or an authoritarian form of government, anarchy, or civil war?
Well, let me ask you, so you talk about authoritarian. So I had someone ask me, is the method that we have moved on to, is a press briefing authoritarian? Is Twitter usage authoritarian? Is chopper talk, and for those who don't know, that's when President Trump was walking out to the Marine One helicopter, and that was the only time that the press got to hear from President Trump in front of the helicopter chopper. Are those authoritarian forms of press presentation or release? I'm not sure what the phrasing should be for that, because otherwise you're not being allowed to question what's going on when the person in charge just comes up and says, here's what I have to say, no questions asked, and then walks off.
So I think the question of authoritarianism is alarmingly on a lot of people's minds right now. But I think it's important also to understand the broader context within which different media are used and how they're used. Because, you know, they're going back as far as there have been journalists and presidents, there has been a struggle over who is going to control the news agenda, who is going to shape what the American people find out, the information that they receive. And it's interesting to me that the issue in a form that we can understand it today really starts getting raised in the 1920s, specifically around the Scopes Monkey Trial. The trial, it's very famous in like the play and movie Inherit the Wind. But observers at the time were, what they were interested in is not the issue of evolution, but what happens when you have a belief system. Here, you know, a set of religious beliefs that challenges the values of reason and the Enlightenment and education as a solution to moving our society forward. Because if I, you know, have a set of religious beliefs, and this is just what I believe, what do we do with that when it runs up against scientific developments or political developments? And I'm getting, this is a kind of a strange way, but it gets right back to this question of how we define authoritarianism, because the solution that emerged in the 20th century came out of this worry that, you know, the world had become a very complex place. And the United States was increasingly engaged in kind of political decision making that was about international affairs or even national affairs. And the reason that was important is ordinary citizens didn't have any direct knowledge of that. It's not like local politics where you know your neighbors, you can see what's going on. Now, there's this complicated world that we are dealing with. And there was skepticism about how well citizens would be able to deal with that. And the response was what we now take for granted as a kind of golden age in the past of broadcast news and the dominance of professional journalism.
Our guest today, Professor Bruce Williams, UVA's Department of Media Studies, as we talk about media and politics, amazing topic. We're here for the rest of the hour on The Wren. Hang tight. Be right back. And thanks for being here with us on Sunday. Professor Bruce Williams is here with us as we talk about using media in politics. He's from UVA's Department of Media Studies. Professor Williams, before the break, you were talking about professional journalism and worldwide news. Can you tell me more?
So the question was, you know, how are citizens who are not, terribly interested in politics all the time, and yet this is a democratic society, we want citizens to participate, so how do we think about the information that they get about the world that is the basis for them making decisions, who they're going to vote for, what their position is on issues? And the press is an important, vital, maybe the institution through which that kind of information comes. And in the 1930s, with the emergence of radio as really the first mass medium, there is a very vigorous debate in the United States about radio is enormously powerful. It's going to reach into everyone's home. And it's an incredible conduit of information. And to cut a long story short, the solution was that we kept a private system of media. Media corporations are privately owned. They are profit maximizing. But in the case of radio and later television, they were given that right to use the public airwaves in return for a public service obligation. And that's where news on radio and later television comes. And that's where the role of professional journalists becomes really important, because what was happening is that especially if we think about television, which I think most of us are a little more familiar with, up until the mid-1980s and 1990s, the place that everyone got their political information from was the nightly network news, 30 minutes less, 6 minutes of commercial. And virtually the entire polity, all citizens, watched one of the three nightly network news broadcasts. And what that meant is that was kind of, if you think about information flowing through gates, that was one of the only gates through which people could find out about the wider world. We didn't have the internet, obviously. You heard the news once a day, twice a day if you read a newspaper. But the point is that those gates were controlled by professional journalists who were committed to a set of professional ethics about telling both sides of the story, not being partisan, and on and on. And what that meant is that at the end of the day, there could still be vigorous disagreement over issues. What there wasn't disagreement over the basic kind of facts of the matter or what the most important issues were, because what set the agenda was what was on the nightly network news broadcast. And the power of that system was that it assembled every night almost the entire public and gave them the same sort of perspective on the world. And it didn't change their attitudes, it didn't change their positions on issues, but what it did is it determined what was important and what people were going to talk about the next day at work or, around the breakfast table. And that system was a way of controlling, if you will, and I'm thinking about that idea about authoritarianism, that was a system that was not really understood that much, but what it did was it gave broadcasters and journalists and the politicians that worked with them very powerful control over the political agenda. And that had a lot of advantages, and it also had some disadvantages, but that was the system. And that's not there anymore.
Well, let me ask you.
Because I
can see that one of the paths to continue on is the change from the nightly news to the social media distribution, and how the Trump administration, however you want to describe it being, was functioning in a world with social media distribution of news. Do you think that that is the distinguishing fact of the Trump administration? The style of the news, however untruthful?
So, in short, I think yes. I think it's a big difference, and it was something that really highlighted some of the weaknesses of the media environment that really emerged with, and it's not just social media. I mean, the broadcast news model really began collapsing around when cable television came in and when 24-hour cable networks came in. But so it's important to know, this is just one of those historical tidbits that I love, is the very term fake news, that originates in the 1930s. And the fake news in the 1930s was aimed by newspapers and political leaders. It was aimed at German propaganda broadcasts in American English that were aimed at the United States. And that was called fake news. I mean, in some ways, I suppose you could say it anticipates questions about Russian influence over our communication system. But what's different now is the uses of social media that the Trump administration developed, because they began, you know, as we started out this conversation, with not holding press briefings, not making the president available to speak, you know, to answer questions from the press. And what he was able to do is sideline all of that and communicate directly with his supporters. And at that point, we're in a sort of a different world, because I think that any media system, you know, in the end, I keep thinking back to the question you asked about authoritarianism. It's dependent on responsible political leaders. It is dependent upon an unstated tacit consensus about what is acceptable and what is unacceptable to do for political gain. And Donald Trump, for a lot of different reasons, was not committed or maybe even knowledgeable of that idea, that democracy is sustained not simply through a written constitution or the laws. It's sustained by a deeper consensus, what I would call kind of a belief, a faith in democracy. And by communicating with no real commitment to facts or the long-run impact of what he was doing, I think that the Trump administration was able to undermine many of those norms that we really didn't fully appreciate or understand.
So you mentioned, you mentioned fake news as something that goes back to the 1930s. But for the past 4 years, it's certainly been used thousands of times, however many zeros you want to put behind the one. I'm curious your belief in with media and politics and having faith in the facts. How do newspapers and broadcast and cable news battle that stigma of the term fake news?
So I think, you know, the phrase fake news, it's one of those phrases that it's hard to take seriously anymore, because I think it's been way overused. And I think that the danger here, and where it really begins to challenge any sort of commitment to the truth or, you know, the facts of the matter, is in the way it speaks to individual citizens outside of established political paths of communication. I think the question you asked is such a good one about where are, you know, professional journalists, where are newspapers, where is the broadcast news? And I think it's important to step back and say that, like most of our economy, the emergence of social media, the internet, companies like Amazon, they have so disrupted the business model of legacy media like, you know, broadcast television and newspapers, that we have to remember newspapers are not a, you know, they're not a public charity. They're not nonprofits. They need to make money, as do broadcast networks, cable networks. And so in this situation, I think that they have been kind of edging into some kind of tacit emerging cooperation with these new forms of media. And what I mean, and I think the Trump administration sped all of this up. These were trends that were well established before 2016, but they were sped up. And one of the ways that they were sped up is that Donald Trump, because of the patterns of his communication with his public that we talked about, posed an enormous challenge for professional journalists. I mean, what do you do with a president who just keeps telling lies? He just tells lie after lie after lie. And if you read, you know, the paper of record, the New York Times, it is interesting to look at how they've changed over the last 4 years, because the language they use in their news reporting is different than it used to be. They went through a struggle about what do you call a lie that the president states? Do you call it a lie, which seems like you're engaging in this political battle? But if you just, you know, say, well, this is disputed or there's another side to this, then you really haven't done anything to challenge this communication of lies. And I think that we are in a situation where it's impossible to think that the Biden administration is just going to be able to go back to the old ways of doing things and make believe that Trump and the way he communicated never happened. Because that's just, I think you can't put the genie back in the bottle now. And what all of this, in my mind, one of the basic issues that it raises is, are our, you know, do we think that our fellow citizens are capable of coming to informed and rational positions on the issues that confront them, which is the same issue that the framers faced, but it's in a very different form now. And the power of this ability to communicate with a very specific audience, you know, we saw that not yesterday when we saw its repudiation, but we saw it, 2 weeks ago on Wednesday, where we had, and it's important to stop and remember This was an armed insurrection in the American capital where you had protesters supporting Donald Trump trying to find the vice president of the United States so they could hang him. And to the extent that there is something positive about that, I think that where we go from here, in my mind, depends a lot on the Republican Party's reckoning with all of this. You know, are they willing to follow someone like Mitt Romney, who said, you know, the solution to this problem is to tell our supporters the truth? Or Mitch McConnell, who talked about kind of the lie of a stolen election. I mean, that's the big issue we have here, that even though Joe Biden has been elected, there is a substantial proportion of the American public that doesn't believe he was elected legitimately, that this election was stolen. And I don't know how you remedy that. I mean, I think it's the challenge we face right now.
Our guest today, Professor Bruce Williams, UVA's Department of Media Studies, as we talk about using media in politics. Let's take our next break and we'll come back. And thanks for being with us today, 97.9 The Wren. We're always glad to be back for another week. And thanks to The Wren for making space with us on their Sunday mornings. Professor Bruce Williams here with us. Professor, you mentioned the insurrection on January 6th of 2021. Well, we're talking about media. So I'd like to talk about how media, whether legacy media, which, as you mentioned, was more of your traditional newspaper, television, cable TV, and social media, how those were used to alert people that January 6th was an event in discussion, and how possibly alternative media, social media sites, were used to plan the event sort of in the background, in the darkness. Can you talk about that?
Yes. So, yes, because I think the social media platforms for white supremacist groups is really, it's been pushed into darkness now in the wake of January 6th. But I think it's important to remember that the organizing, the motivation, the enthusiasm for an armed insurrection against the United States and all the people who came to that rally and that wound up in the Capitol, all of them, you know, were not arriving there with zip ties and maps of the Capitol. They were caught up in the moment. But that moment was communicated on Facebook and Twitter and YouTube. And so it was done in the light. It was done in a way that anyone could have seen it. And that was a lot of its power. And I think that the decision by Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube and other social media companies to deplatform things like Parler, to ban Donald Trump from using any of these platforms, that was the reaction to this planning and the communication of something, you know, that the election was stolen, that is just not true. But what is problematic, I think, is who gets to make these decisions? Because while I agree that that President Trump incited this insurrection, I'm very uncomfortable with the idea that a private corporation can decide to ban the President of the United States. I just find that an alarming precedent, because if we go back to earlier periods of American history that I've been talking about, the debates over radio and television were in Congress. They were in the political system. And when you do that, what that means is the whole debate is infused with this idea of a public purpose. This is a political decision. This is something that affects the quality of discourse in a political system.
Well, Professor, let me ask you a question. Let me butt in, because you mentioned earlier, and I'm not going to phrase this correctly, but you mentioned earlier about Thomas Jefferson, and give me the proper phrase here, having expectations that the general public would do something,
would be informed and interested and capable.
That's where I want to go with this question. Okay. How does the general public know who to trust or who to believe if what happens now is you can look and choose what to read or listen to over, you can select your own media, but it's all cognitive bias. It's, I prefer the news that Fox Media is putting out, so I choose to listen to Fox Media because those are my beliefs. I prefer to believe the news that MSNBC puts out, so that's what I choose to listen to. Or I choose to read these types of newspapers, but the problem is that legacy media can be easily purchased and have its focus altered by some other company on either side of the debate, or your social media that you believe in can be easily shut down by anyone on either side of the debate. How does that work?
That's the question, isn't it? I think that, you know, as I've been saying, there have been a few solutions, because that, again, that is a basic problem of democracy, is what are the capabilities of ordinary citizens who are, you know, the source of legitimacy in a democracy. And at first we thought public education would do that. And as someone who spent my entire life in education, the last few years have made me really question, you know, whether I was at all successful. But then, as the world became more complicated, we evolved a system where the kind of information that was passing to the public was heavily vetted and edited. And it all came from, you know, journalists who had a set of professional ethics. Now, I think that, first of all, it's important to understand that social media is not totally distinct from more traditional sources of information. One of the things that is very important is the role that Fox News, for example, plays in amplifying things that are going and legitimating things that are going around on social media. So, you know, I could go back to things like the tragic killing of Seth Rich, a Democratic worked for the National Democratic Committee, and he was murdered. And there's an elaborate conspiracy theory about he was killed because of Hillary Clinton and her emails or some such thing. And one of the reasons that's so powerful is because it was repeated on Fox News by Sean Hannity and Laura Ingraham. And the reason that this happens at a higher level is that Fox, you know, that's where their audience is, that's where their money is. But I think that right now we're in a situation where I think there is some cause for optimism. And the reason for that is that I think that between the COVID pandemic, the fact that over 400,000 Americans are dead, the Black Lives Matter protests, and now, most importantly, the attempt to overturn a Democratic election by groups that organized through social media. I think it may be a wake-up call to citizens and also to political leaders who are the primary ones who've kind of weaponized social media, used it for very narrow political purposes. And I think there is a little bit of a reckoning. And I don't think we know what's going to come out of it, but we're all talking about it, I think, now. I know it's a weird cause for optimism, but I've been reading articles about how the QAnon conspiracy community, do we have to explain what QAnon is? An insane conspiracy theory, which was circulated primarily through social media and often banned from deplatformed. But now, where the core of that conspiracy theory was that somehow Donald Trump was going to expose the nefarious carryings on of the elite that's been in control. When he just left the White House and Joe Biden entered and he acknowledged the transfer of power, that contradicted the QAnon conspiracy theory. And what's happened is a fair amount of people have said, look, I was misled. I was lied to. I have to try and recover my old life before I believed in this. And I think there's a sense in which, that might be this traumatic period we've been in, where people believe falsehoods about the pandemic. They believe falsehoods about the persistence of racism in the United States. They deny that. And the election, which is the most important thing, that people believed a falsehood that led to one of the greatest challenges to the stability of American politics in 200 years. And one hopes that that will be a little bit of a wake-up call. And whether it is or not depends not less on ordinary citizens than on what political leaders do. So is, for example, someone like Josh Hawley, are they going to adopt the communication strategies of the Trump administration, which is to say, I'm not going to listen to the mainstream media. I'm not going to listen to journalists. What I'm going to do is I am going to just step in and try and remobilize Trump supporters. Is that going to be the dominant role with the Republican Party, or are people like Mitch McConnell and Mitt Romney, who kind of stared into the abyss 2 weeks ago, are they going to regain a sense of public responsibility? And I think those are the important questions. I think the Democratic Party, I mean, the Biden administration, they have the greatest challenge since Roosevelt was elected. But I think it's up to the Republican Party what's going to happen to them now, that they mobilize supporters, they spread this lie, the president helped, and you had a violent insurrection. And what do you do with that? And again, to go back historically, it's interesting to remember where the Republican Party comes from. The Republican Party started because the Whig Party, that was one of the two major political parties in the United States, it split over the issue of slavery. There was a Northern Whig faction that became the Republican Party. And is the Republican Party, as it's constituted now, is it going to go forward, or is it going to be really restructured? There are noises about forming a, you know, kind of a patriot party, a third party. But all of those things are on the table, and it's those underlying the structures of political power and how elections work and so on, that's going to determine how social media is used. Social media is not going away, but the question is, how is it used? What are the responsibilities that are adopted by political leaders when they don't have reporters to kind of vet and edit and critique what they're saying for political reasons?
Well, Professor, let me ask you this. We're nearing the end of the show. Again, Professor Bruce Williams with us, UVA Department of Media Studies. We're talking about using media in politics. So you were talking about how media is going to view things now, how will current politicians change their conversations with the media. I'm curious about how the religious media, whether legacy or social, cover two very different presidents. Many of the religious media groups supported President Trump for his policies while ignoring his behavior. And we have a new president, Biden, has policies that these same religious media groups might find distasteful, while his personal behavior seems like something they would want to promote. So how do they go about making their choice here?
That's such a great question, because, when I was talking before about the significance of the Scopes Monkey trial in 1920, that's one of the reasons that's an important event, is because a lot of the issues that were raised there were never really resolved. And I think that the question of religious belief and religious freedom, it's so baked in, at rightfully, to the origins of the United States, that religious belief is kind of a separate realm that we don't want to get, we don't want to begin to censor or, tell them to do something different. At the same time, I think in the wake of the Trump administration, I think that especially evangelicals, they are in the same situation as the Republican Party, where, in the Republican Party, you have the Lincoln Project, you have Mitt Romney, there are a lot of stressors that are really pressuring the Republican Party right now. And I think the evangelical community is facing the same thing. I think, and it's been aided by some of the scandals that have emerged around certain political leaders of the evangelical movement. But I think they're going through the same reckoning. I hope that the ways religious communities use social media to influence politics. I think there is going to be a reckoning. I think there's going to be perhaps tensions, splits especially the evangelical community. What I want to say is, the most fundamental changes, I think, in the United States, they come at moments of enormous crisis, national crises. Think about the Great Depression. Think about World War II. I think that this was a moment like that. And I don't think the solution can be to monitor and control more closely what people say and do on media, although I think it's problematic that so much of our public discourse occurs on these privately controlled and owned platforms. But I think the solution is what emerges from this enormous crisis. And I think the dimensions of this crisis are not clear. I mean, what is the economy going to look like a year from now? Is COVID really going to be vanquished? What happens to the movement for racial justice? And what do we make of what happened on January 6th? And that, you know, that is going to, that's, I think, a more important issue, a more decisive issue than the shape and structure of social media. Because I think we come back to this idea that, the foundation of democracy is a belief in democracy, a faith in democracy. And that's what was so challenged over the last couple of months.
Professor, thank you so much for joining in with us today. I feel like we could go on for another couple hours. Plenty of material. Yeah. I hope you'll come back in the future.
I would love to. I love this, and this, I thoroughly enjoyed myself, and thank you for inviting me. It was a pleasure.
Sunday morning wake-up call. Professor Bruce Williams, UVA's Department of Media Studies. We'll see you next Sunday.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on Real Oldies 97.9 The Wren. The Wake-Up Call is produced by Dan Gould. Show archives can be found at cvillepodcast.com. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for The Wake-Up Call, only on 97.9 The Wren.